This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Imagine it's the 1970s, the golden years of rock and roll. And you are one of the biggest rock stars in the world. Let's say you're David Bowie. Golden years. And this cutting-edge magazine that everyone in the industry is taking notice of sends a reporter to interview you, and in walks a 16-year-old boy. Cameron Crowe is still probably best known for his personal story, the child prodigy who convinced Rolling Stone to let him embed with rock superstars at age 16, as told in his brilliant coming-of-age movie, Almost Famous, for which he received an Academy Award for Best Screenplay. But before he won that Oscar, Cameron Crowe spent his high school years on tour with the legends of rock.
My dream kind of ended with a story on the cover of Rolling Stone. I was like, that may never happen. And then it happened when I was 16.
Right.
So it was like, okay, let's recalibrate the dream.
But when you go to make movies, was that inevitable? Did you always say, that's what I'm going to do?
No, that was a bonus. That was a bonus thing. That was coming from a family that worshipped Mike Nichols and Elaine May. And that stuff was playing, and my mom would take me to see Carnal Knowledge on opening weekend, argue with the theater owner to, like, get me in. I'll take him outside if anything's coming up. Of course, she's like, stay, don't leave. She wants me to see it all. And so movies were a big part of our world. And Jan and Ben Funk Torres kept me doing stories that were inching towards cinema. So I got to kind of blend a little bit.
Were you thinking cinema during that time?
Starting to, because I loved Sissy Spacek. Loved Carrie and loved, what she was starting to do with Altman. And so
as a fan,
Coal Miner's Daughter came together while we were on assignment for a cover story for Rolling Stone. It was Annie Leibovitz and me and Sissy, who said, oh, let's go see Loretta Lynn. I have to turn her down for this project. She's been trying to get me to do her life story for 6 months. So I have to go and actually face-to-face say no. Well, come with me. So we
cover
all
that.
Go. Yeah, cover that. So we road trip to a Loretta Lynn show with Sissy Spacek. Alec, Loretta Lynn closed Sissy in about 10 minutes. It's like as soon as she saw Sissy, they got into it. Boom. She was going to play that part that won her an Oscar. And it was just one of those great moments where I get to be fly on a wall for this stuff and starting to see how films happen. Mm-hmm. But that was a dream that was really far away at that
time. Does it also time out when Jan leaves the West Coast and goes to New York? Does it all kind of come together where you're like, you're done with that now that you're not going to New York? Do you ever talk about going to New York?
No, I was kind
or
of—
continuing with them when you live on the West Coast?
And I stayed in L.A. and kind of worked in that office and stayed independent because I didn't want to be somebody who would be given an assignment and have to do it. So I was always kind of a freelancer, but I had an editor position. So it was kind of the perfect thing. And then it grew into the idea of telling the story about kids from a kid's point of view. And I had been writing all these stories about, like, Rod Stewart and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And you would hear them talk about the fans. And you would see the fans follow them through these situations. But at a certain point, I was kind of like, let's just turn the observation over to those people who follow Rod Stewart, for example. And the stories just became endless, just interviewing people. And that grew into a desire to capture characters.
And the first, when you wrote the book Fast Times, mm-hmm. and it wasn't a novel, it was a real story.
Like it's a nonfiction novel.
Nonfiction novel.
Yeah.
You're the Truman Capote of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. Who tells you you're going to make that as a movie? How does it become a movie?
Art Linson and Irving Azoff and a few people that kind of knew the music world and knew my writing liked the book a lot. And Art Linson, I remember, really loved Spicoli, the surfer.
Sure.
And that always felt like a great character if we were able to get the right guy to do it.
Sean isn't necessarily somebody who comes in and nails the reading. He wasn't necessarily the guy.
Yeah. And we heard like, oh, there's this guy. He's like kind of a young De Niro guy. He's really good. He's from Malibu. Let's read him. So he came in. And there were three of us in the room. And he said, I know how to do this part. We're like, great. Do it.
Have
he's
at
like,
it.
No. I'll do it when you hire me.
Yeah, I'm not giving him a shit.
For some reason, we just decided to hire him without ever seeing him do it. It was kind of like, what the fuck happened? And he was stayed in character the whole movie. Yep. He had us call him Jeff. And I would try and get him to do parts of the character before it was time to actually film. Wouldn't do it. And then he just busted out with the character on the day. And we're like, oh, my God. This is the guy.
That's it's Spicoli.
Like, yeah, yeah. It's like a documentary version of Spicoli.
Hard to believe that that's him. You go see other, you know, with other chameleon things. He did Falcon and the Snowman and things like that. Very strange.
When did you meet him?
I met him. I don't remember when I met him, but I remember first seeing him there and thinking he was like this, you know, crazy comic genius.
Yeah.
He was like a Peter Sellers to me almost.
You know,
he just completely occupied the character. You know, and all the classic lines that I don't want to bore everybody with, but for people who are not familiar with the movie, you know, people on lewd should not drive, all that stuff. We all were gagging laughing. We watched everybody watches Fast Times. You watch the movie for Sean Penn's performance, and we would just be gagging, laughing. And there was some really, and in the middle of the laughing, and in the middle of the kind of madness of it, and Ray Walston and ordering the pizza and everything, is Jennifer Jason Leigh's story. And I made a movie with her, and who's there's nobody deeper than her. She's one of the deepest actresses I've ever worked with, and very real.
Yeah,
she's cool.
She was ready for the movie to be even more raw and real. I mean, there was some conversation when the movie first came out that, like, this is a hard R. This is really more than we want to see from our young kids today. And she was the first one to say, like, I wish it was X. There was nudity on me that they cut out that I wish they'd kept in, which was, like,
rare.
Super bold and, like, you know, visionary, knew where she was headed. The thing, though, was
Tannen and all those guys going, this movie's like, you know, we're going to release it in 200 theaters. This is a piece of crap or whatever. Yeah. We shouldn't be making movies like this.
We snuck it through. And when they started to see it, they realized that Amy Heckerling had gone for the raw truth, you know, of like what Jennifer Jason Leigh's character had gone through, gotten pregnant and an abortion. And Amy had this brilliant kind of take on it, which was, let's just show it. How was it for you when you saw it? Okay, Amy, it was like this. Let's shoot that. So she had this very naturalistic, funny approach that when people saw it, they laughed. The thing, though, was Spicoli was our magic. That was our bit of magic. And the studio and the people involved in the movie, maybe Art Linson knew the potential there. But everybody who made those plans, like on opening weekend, we're going to drive around, we're going to get together, we'll pick you up. We'll pick you up. We'll come and get you. We'll all go together. We'll get like two cars. We'll caravan. As it gets closer to the weekend that the movie comes out, it's like, I'm going to be out of town. Are you going to go? I can't make it. So it turned out nobody would go and do like a victory tour of the theaters for Fast Times. So I got in a car and drove to Arizona to go to my friend's wedding that I didn't think I would be able to go to. Oh, was I available to go to his wedding? And I went with a buddy, and we start to get close to Phoenix, Tucson, where we're going, and we're like, let's go to a theater. Let's just see the empty theater showing Fast Times. We go in. It's packed. There's already kids who have gotten the checkerboard vans, gone to the mall, gotten them, and come back to see the movie. And I was sitting
Spicoli
there going,
is the Fagin
fucking
that
Spicoli
into
drives them into the theater and saves the movie, really. They never caught up because they cut our theaters at the last minute. They were like, nobody in the East Coast is going to go see this movie. And then, like, those theaters ended up being packed.
Right. You'd never written a screenplay before.
I had not.
You wrote the book. How did the people, even though it's a small movie, how
do you
get—
I love you've done this research, Alec. You're, like, the busiest guy.
But how did they get you to do that? I mean, how did you get them to let you write the
screenplay? Cheapest guy available. It's like they bought the book and they were like—
We're not spending any money on it. Let him write it.
Let him write it.
Right.
Let him write it.
We'll give him $12.
$12, and maybe he'll pay us $15
if we
ask him.
Coffee and donuts for a week.
Coffee.
Was Amy on board then, or did you work with her?
No, script was done. Script was done, and Tom Mount, again, the guy at Universal, was kind of our secret patron, you know, helping us out and everything, said, I got this great idea who could direct it. He's done this film, Eraserhead. He's really a talented guy. David Lynch is his name. And I saw Eraserhead. Of course, Eraserhead's amazing. I'm like, you know, if he'll read the script, absolutely. So I give him the script, and he was really great about it. And David Lynch, like, drove back a couple days later in a, I believe it was a white VW Bug, and very politely said, fun story, not really what I think I'm going to be doing. It's a bad David Lynch. But he appreciated it enough so that they kept looking. And then Amy had done this short called Getting It Over With about a young girl losing her virginity. It was fantastic. And so we're like, let's go guerrilla lo-fi and make it.
What do you write after Fast Times?
We did.
So you wrote the screenplay. The film comes out and eventually becomes this kind of this cult classic comedy. So are you like fully smitten then? You're like, I'm going down that road now. Far less Rolling Stone essays, that kind of writing.
I always feel like it's been journalism all the time. But it was kind of, you know, amorphous, trying to get to what the story would be. I was trying to tell other people's stories. But the more Almost Famous became utterly personal, the more it became the movie it should be.
Well, wasn't there something before Almost Famous in between?
Many. But it's like that was the first thing that I went to after Fast Times. It's like, I want to get into the music
thing. You started creating that.
Characters and music, because it was so fun putting the music on Fast Times that you could take a song like Somebody's Baby, which like in this part of the movie, it's just kind of nice pop. But if you put it over a kid having premature ejaculation, all of a sudden it's like kind of psychedelic in the song You'll Never Forget as you remember it.
Yeah.
And then later you run into Jackson Brown. He's like, thanks a lot. Thought I was writing you a nice little ballad. And now I'm like a poster boy for jacking off and coming too fast. It's like, I was like, thank you.
Jackson, come
thank
on.
You.
It's art.
And that was kind of like the beginning of, wow, you can use these songs and really make the music a character. And that became the
Don't
thing.
You see people that are doing that, though, when you think that they're not doing that well? Without naming names. I'm not going to judge people. I'm just saying for me, I'll see movies sometimes and I'll be like, enough.
Enough
of you telling. I get it. We're in the 70s. I get it. Your script is anemic and you want to bolster it with, Knights in White Satin or something. I get it. Their great music is going to make your movie great.
Yeah. And they just use it for a minute while somebody's car door opens and then shuts.
Yeah.
Rather than like let the song play. Scorsese was always the guy that could give you a fast buzz of like, here's a guy that knows music and he's going to give you this Ronettes record and it's going to rip your soul out, you know, this because he knows how
when
to
you're
do
on
that.
A cocaine run all of a sudden.
Indeed.
With Ray.
Yeah.
You and Ray are jonesing.
Yeah. Or you're looking at that helicopter and Nilsson is got that track going and you're like, take me there.
Cameron Crowe is a master of the moment. The needle drops, the song comes on, and you're there, filled with teenaged longing. Lloyd Dobler holding up the boombox and Say Anything, Jerry Maguire's You Had Me at Hello, and comic perfection, Sean Penn's puckish stoner, Jeff Spicoli.
Just what in the hell do you think you're doing?
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Mr. Spicoli, you're on dangerous ground here. You're causing a major disturbance on my time.
I've been thinking about this, Mr. Hand. If I'm here and you're here, doesn't that make it our time? Certainly, there's nothing wrong with a little feast on our time.
After the break, Cameron Crowe tells me what John Cusack was like on the set of Say Anything. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. That's Neil Young's Cinnamon Girl, used by Cameron Crowe to give an unsentimental, retro rock feel to a montage sequence in 2011's We Bought a Zoo. Now, more from my conversation with Crowe about going from screenwriting success to taking full creative control of his films.
What's the first one you directed?
Say Anything. James L. Brooks, he said like, okay, we have two other people that we've always talked about. And if the second one on that list, if the second one says no,
you
really got to think about it. And the second one was, in fact, Lawrence Kasdan, who said, you know, if I was prolific and did a movie a year, I would do this. But I'm doing Accidental Tourist, and that's going to be my movie in the next 2 years. But I'm going to call the studio and tell them James Brooks is right and you should direct it. So that got me the directing job.
On Say Anything. How did you find that the first time you directed? What was it like for you to direct
fucking
actors? And how was that changed?
Scared to death.
Really? Cusack is their lead.
Cusack. It was a wide shot in a nursing home. And he gave the speech. And I kind of turned around to everybody and said, I like it. It's good. I think we have it. And they kind of like, hey, come over here. Let's get some liquid water. You have to do a thing called coverage. You have to shoot it from other angles. I'm like, okay, other angles.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah. Other angles, everyone.
Terrified. I went to the trailer and just like was in a upright fetal position. And Clay Griffith, my good buddy who's like been production designer for all the movies lately, Clay Griffith says, you got to get outside of the trailer and you should go have lunch with the crew and tell the crew just by being there that you're with them and you're all making the movie together. And it was like the greatest advice.
Wow.
I left the trailer, obviously never left hanging with the crew.
Right.
It's the only way to make a movie is to love your crew and to be with them.
And what about the actors?
Serve you. The actors, I didn't realize until we were halfway through what great partners they could be. Like John Mahoney and Cusack are like these Chicago brawlers. They're like, they just want to tear your scene.
Let's do 30 takes.
Let's do 30 takes. Like Johnny would be like, let me do one where I throw John Mahoney across the table. I'm like, you're supposed to be kind of like the nonviolent guy. Well, let me just do one where I do this. And it's like, yeah, okay, let's do that.
Now, let me make out with him. Let me kiss him on the mouth. They're not throwing through the wall.
We kind of found through collaboration like how to get a really good language, first-time director style on that movie. And I fell in love with directing actors.
And like, you worked with him again since then? You worked with Cusack the one time?
Tried to a couple of times and we've missed, but I think that's still out there.
So there is sometimes, so for you, there is there the notion that you have kind of a battery with them as a director and an actor and you think, well, I can get movies made with this guy. It's like Scorsese with Leo now. He's his De Niro.
Yeah.
You thought about that.
I love that. That's, you know, why I'll always call you.
I was going to say, now, when you have to say anything, what do you do?
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
When we were going over movies that we were going to talk about, there were so many like super strong leading man movies, like just, you know, double fisted. I'm going to give you the story. I'm going to hit my mark and give it to you, man. It was like there are not many of those movies made anymore. And I saw them on that list and I was like, damn.
Yeah.
Studios used to make movies that were both personal and universal. And without a lot of fear, it seemed, and so now there's these canon of movies that are feeling like they're from the distant past, which is strange because we got to start making like these movies that are kind of our version of that today. There's a lot of whimsical stories being told, but I just like the like straight up, let's tell you an American story quality. Then there was Woodstock on the list, of course.
Which I'm obsessed with.
Equally important in every way. It's like I'm obsessed with it too. And Monterey Pop.
Yeah.
Monterey Pop is amazing for the crowd shots. Monterey Pop has the most beautiful crowd shots. They're like composed.
I have to go back and watch that.
Oh my God. They're so great. And they also tell you that thing of like in 1967, it wasn't all the 60s. It was still like there were dudes from the 50s still there in the shots. You know, they go to the show too. They didn't get the manual for the muumuu to wear. They're still wearing like, you know, a little skinny black tie. And you see these things in Monterey Pop and you just go, wow, somebody was there at the right time with the camera, just captured the generation changing. And it was crazy.
Well,
and Woodstock's amazing.
The end of that, the end of that time where like, I always get so upset when people say the 60s was for nothing. But I want to get back to something you said, which is about Monterey and Woodstock, which is, I'm on the board of the Hamptons Film Festival and we have our festival. So we do Gimme Shelter, and we find out that Maisels is in Sag Harbor visiting his daughter who lives there. We bring him in to interview him. It's sold out, and everybody comes in. And everybody, like, no, there's no dope in the room, but you can smell the dope in the room. Everyone gets a contact high.
This is really true, Alec. This is like the souvenirs of that era people are gravitating to so strongly. Like, that's why they showed up for Gimme Shelter. I went to see Richie Fure, you know, who packed a nice-sized theater singing Buffalo Springfield type stuff. It's like people are there for the things that moved them in their lives.
It's like these reboots of TV shows. It's like bringing back Will and Grace.
Yeah. But and if Will and Grace comes back with the feeling that you got, that contact high the first time, and they have, you're like,
they're in.
That's a miracle.
No, but I know that you did Reunion with Elton John and
Leon Russell.
Leon Russell. Oh, couple baby. Of numbers from Leon. I know that you did the Reunion with him. Why didn't you make more movies like that, like concert films? Why didn't you marry?
We're going to do it.
You are.
We're doing it. Yeah. It just, the movies have taken me like a long time because they take a long time to write. And then I, you know, maybe put one aside for a while and start a new one. So it's like as I've kind of streamlined that process a little bit, there's room to do music stuff. So we're actually going to do a couple documentaries and a few music things. One thing I guess I can say is we're going to do a little documentary with David Crosby, who I first met when I was 15. He's you know, more prolific now than he's been in a long time. He's at a point in his life where he's just got a lot to say. And I think with a lack of a lot of talking heads and leaving it with him just telling you almost all just a very personal thing, I'm going to tell you some stuff you'll agree with, some stuff you won't, but it's just between me and you. This is my life. Like, I love that tone, tone. So we're going to do that with David Crosby, who's wonderful. And
I
just love
him to come
it.
Do the show, yeah.
Well,
I begged him.
You know the music, you know? Listen, we made Almost Famous, and here's this note that comes in the mail, like, immediately, and it's from Alec Baldwin. I'm like, fuck! Open it up, and it's like, I loved your movie. I love Led Zeppelin. I can't believe you put Tangerine in the movie.
That's the way.
Alec, that's the way.
That's the way.
That's the way. And I was like, Alec Baldwin knows That's the Way and Zeppelin?
Oh, man.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, my God.
And
fandom. I never lose that fandom. And
that's
you
so
don't.
Good.
And
no,
you don't.
You can't, because I just think you have to sign on for the people that you love creatively and personally. Take the ride.
But
John Lennon can make Mind Games. He can make, you know, it's one of the in-between records. Don't leave him. He's John Lennon. You know, it's like you just have to stay for the ride. Or you're a fair weather fan.
Did you get that from your mother?
A little bit, yeah.
Of pretentiousness.
Well,
you won an Academy Award for screenwriting, as I reminded your children.
Yes, thank you for that. You also called them charismatic.
I told your children, I said, your mother's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and your father won an Oscar. I said, you know, no pressure. But
you're doing well, by the way.
Tell them I said hi. But I think
it's super important, and I think you can even make movies that way. You can be loving with the point you're trying to make with a movie, and stay open, and be open to your actors too, because generally, not every time, but generally, a movie will have your spirit. The movie will have your signature somewhere. Even in movies where, like, you know, Penny Marshall came in at the last minute and replaced so-and-so, it's a Penny Marshall movie. The director's personality seeps in. Hallelujah. And I love playing with that. I love playing with, like, the sensibility and the feeling that the movie is going to give you. Music helps. The relationship on the set, like, when we've been able to work together, It's really been wonderful to have, like, the environmental version of directing where we all are together kind of vibing, and there are relationships that are separate and the characters are part of it, and we're doing this thing together. I think that feeling gets into the movie.
So would you say that Jerry Maguire, that blows things open for you?
Yes.
That's a big hit movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's you got number one on the call sheet there.
Yeah.
I just came from London shooting with him. And it's a singular experience. Number one, when you work with Thomas, you can never complain that you're tired.
Yeah.
And you can never complain that you're in pain.
I saw it happen once.
Tom broke his leg in October, like really fucking smashed his leg to pieces.
I know.
And he's back to work in like 9 weeks or whatever the fuck it was. So when you work with him, I love him.
The best.
So you could do the movie. That obviously changes everything for you.
Yeah. When he said yes, that did change things. But he said it in a way, Alec, that, like, you know, your friends take you aside and say, you know, if Tom Cruise says yes, you lose your power. You can't do a thing. It just becomes a freight train that's out of control, and it's a Hollywood freight train. You'll be lucky if you see the back of the caboose.
Yeah.
And you get terrified, and then Tom Cruise calls from England and said, I read your script. I hope I'm the right guy for you. Let me come out and read it for you. And you're like, wait, you want to come out and read it? He's, yeah, why not know if it's right for both of us? Let me read it for you, see if I'm the guy for you. And he was that guy from the moment he got off the plane.
And you worked with him twice. You worked with him again.
And hope to work with him again.
Now, when you do the movie and the movie becomes a success because you make small movies and you're like everybody, you start off in one place and then you end up in another place. How does that change once the movie makes a lot of money and you're directing movies with big movie stars? Do people like sit back and go, whatever you want, Cameron, whatever you want, baby?
You do.
Things get easier.
You do. Well, we never knew that Jerry Maguire was going to do that well. It's the same old thing, you know, of is it an in-between movie because it's sports and it's also a romance, and sports guys don't want to see romance, and romance is
We're confusing people here.
You're confusing people. So there was a big there's a big issue about, you know, is this one of those Robin Williams movies that, you know, and you're like, I just remember being in these rooms when everybody said, you don't have a star. What are we going to do? Now we have one. And they're like, what are we going to do?
Yeah, we have the star.
So, you know, over Thanksgiving weekend, Bob Cooper cut together, one of the executives who just arrived, I think, cut together a version that was both. And we watched it and it was like, fuck, football can live with Renee Zellweger running through a street and you're feeling love and romance. It's like, it can work. And it was a very, very interesting thing because, like, it was the first Tom Cruise movie that had, like, not a high want to see. So they were doing testing and they were going, like, you know, you're going to get killed by the preacher's wife. It's coming out the same way. You're going to get killed. You know, this is a changing of the guards. This is a new day and, you know, it's going to be Preacher's Wife. Tom was doing the Kubrick movie already at that time. Came from London to New York and said, boys, I'm going to do some promotion. And he started on a Monday, did Rosie, did Larry King, did everything. By the end of the week, our numbers were way high.
He ran the
Preacher's
table.
Wife was starting to go down. And he basically blew us a kiss and went back to England and the movie opened. It was the brawn of him coming to say, okay, guys, I act for free. This is what you pay me for.
Right.
I'm going to give them everything I got for this movie.
And then when that movie comes out and that's a huge hit, that's when you decide you want to do Omaha. You feel like you're ready to do the movie.
That was the back pocket. Now we can do like the labor of love. And they were great. We did it for DreamWorks and Spielberg said, shoot every word, which I'd never heard before or since. And we started to run long.
What were the casting imperatives there? Oh, no, finish what you were saying. We started to run long
and I got a message back like, well, Steven says shoot every other word for a while.
right.
There was no casting imperative. In fact, you'll dig this. It was going to be Brad Pitt as the Billy Crudup character.
Right.
And we worked on it and it just he started to drift away. I still haven't had the definitive conversation with him on why it didn't work out, but it didn't work out.
It happens.
But somewhere I have Brad Pitt and Natalie Portman trying out for Penny Lane. And the portrait of the two of them together is riveting, but a completely different movie.
Wow.
And Spielberg said, cast anybody you want as long as he's right. And it came down to Billy and Christian Bale. And they both were great. And it was kind of like, I'm going to go with Billy. And he learned how to play guitar in 6 weeks and was the guy of destiny.
Oh.
He was the guy of destiny. And they let me make it, you know, with all the so-called bells and whistles, which really was being able to shoot it with John Toll and get all the sets right and go back to San Diego.
Why shot it's complicated with.
Yeah, it's, you
Toll,
know,
the only
amazing.
Person to win the Oscar back-to-back years for Braveheart.
Legends of the Fallen, Braveheart.
And Braveheart, yeah. I love John.
He's great. And I think he worked on Monterey Pop or Woodstock or one of those. I mean, he actually was there shooting for part of that era. So he knew what real was. He knew what authenticity was. And Led Zeppelin said yes and let us use the music, which was incredible.
Oh.
To go to England and show the movie to Led Zeppelin with the editor and sit in a small room on the one day that Jimmy and Robert like spend together going over Zeppelin business. We're in the back row. It's just like five of us. And every time the two heads of Jimmy Page and Robert Plant would come together to talk about something, we'd be like, what are they talking about? And then it was over. They were kind of emotional, and Robert Plant said, "I have a bottle of Quaaludes I've been saving since 1969. I'm going to take one tonight." And then we went across the street and talked about the music. And Jimmy Page says, "I would like one of our acoustic songs, one more of our acoustic songs in there, and I'll let you have it for free. Just find a place for it." And we're like, "Damn. You're supposed to be the people that say no music for anyone."
No.
And so they said, like, the movie's coming from the right place. And how great is Jeff Buckley? And they just started talking about Jeff Buckley, Page and Plant. Like fans, exactly what we're talking about. Like the way you want to hear musicians you love talk about the musicians they love. And it was Jeff Buckley, who unfortunately died playing Immigrant Song. I've heard. I loved all the musicians that helped us on Almost Famous because they all pitched in. They all gave us like a good price on the music and loved that we played so much of it.
Writer, director, journalist, Cameron Crowe. After the break, Cameron Crowe on what it feels like after the success of Jerry Maguire and Almost Famous to have a movie fall flat in the eyes of the outside world. Plus, the story of his definitive interview with the great Billy Wilder, which became the book Conversations with Wilder. This song is Led Zeppelin's Tangerine, which Crowe uses to amp up the nostalgia as the tour bus drives away at the end of Almost Famous. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. That's Led Zeppelin's Misty Mountain Hop, also from Almost Famous. Another great use of song, capturing the swelling pride of Will, the Cameron Crowe character, when he loses his virginity. Now back to the real Cameron Crowe on making a movie that is not a hit.
Is it painful? Is it soul-searching? Do you get in a minivan and drive cross-country and meditate?
It's a great question.
What do you do in the wake of the one where you sit there and go, I miscalculated something?
You definitely do that. But you also know that sometimes time is the component that's not in play yet.
Right.
And over time, stuff that I've done and movies that I've appreciated that other people have done, time adds a little something.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes takes it away. But it adds something. So some of the movies, like Elizabethtown, got a strange reaction when it first came out. I love Elizabethtown. I love what we did.
Mm-hmm.
I love the purpose of Elizabethtown.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody got it. But it's for my dad, as Almost Famous was very much a kind of portrait of my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say something about my dad. And as time goes on, more and more people really get that movie, like really get it.
Yeah.
Like when people started to say to me, I saw your movie or I read something that you wrote and it kind of changed my life. It took me a long time to kind of wrap my head around that. And then it became something that I was so proud of. And if you're able to just like touch people in a certain way, they remember you forever. They remember the movie or the line or the character forever. So I just love the game
and
that's
in play.
And you
realize they're all not going to perform the
they're
same way.
They're all not going to perform. So
that's
the thing
business.
Is like Kirsten Dunst's character in Elizabethtown, for example, like understood, less understood, now kind of understood again.
What's the acronym the guy came up with to describe her character?
Manic Pixie Dream Girl. Yeah. Well, so is Lucille Ball.
Right,
so
right.
Is, you know.
Right, Mary Tyler Moore.
Totally Mary Tyler Moore. And that character was patterned after a real person, so it's kind of authentic too. But the thing is, it's disappointing, but then you never lose the desire to like get back on the horse and just like, you know, do
but
it
stay
again.
Doing what you're doing, meaning maybe it doesn't perform because it is a business according to plan, but you go right back and do it the same way you do it. You don't change the way you do it.
When I first started out, like given the opportunity to do it, my thing was like, I want to make movies about the people that never get movies made about them. And I still believe that. I still, like, Say Anything was that for me. Like, a guy like Lloyd, I mean, it was patterned after my next-door neighbor, really, who was just a completely unique, soulful guy, lived, died at a very young age, was like a young motivational speaker, was a, you know, fledgling kickboxer. I was trying to figure out the main male character in the script, and this guy knocked on my door and said, I'm from Alabama. I'm here in town. My father's under investigation for income tax, and I'm going to be doing some kickboxing later tonight. Would you like to come see me? And I'm like, no, I'm busy trying to come up with a creative character. Wait a minute.
Wait, come back.
Yeah, come back. And that guy, actually, I didn't go watch him kickbox. I said I might and go out to like San Bernardino and watch him kickbox. I didn't make it. Next morning, I hear like boom in our apartment place. You know, boom, boom, boom. What's happening? I go downstairs. He's got a bag hanging from the pipes in the parking garage, and he's working out again. And he turns around and the guy's black and blue. He was decimated in his fight. And I said, I guess it didn't go too well. And he goes, I'm back at it next Friday, and I think I'm going to do well, and I want you there. And I was like, this is a warrior for optimism. I love this
guy.
And
did you go?
And this is life. No, I didn't go.
Why?
But I went and hung with him a lot, and we watched a lot together. So he
you're not making a movie about him?
In the end, Lloyd was
based on him.
Diane was supposed to be the main character when we first started doing Say Anything. The Ione Sky character was the main character. Lloyd kind of took over along with Lowell, my next door neighbor. And that was another thing. It's like real life is going to deliver you some of the best stories. Like you just sit tight and listen and watch because life is the best writer.
Now, of course, you know, when you love movies, classic films, whether they're in the TCM wheelhouse or not, people will say to me, who do you want to work with? Who do you want to work with? I said, well, who do you think I want to work with? I want to work with Bogart. I want to work with John Huston. William Holden. Mm. Mm. I just watched Bridge on the River Kwai the other day again, and blah blah blah. So for you, how does the connection happen? How do you get the hook into Wilder and meet Wilder?
You know, I fell in love with his stuff when we were working on Jerry Maguire. Right. I just fell in love with his stuff, and The Apartment spoke to me in such an amazing way. I got like a vintage poster, and I wanted to go visit Billy Wilder and have him sign it, and I did. And he was kind of—
Where?
At his office in Beverly Hills.
So you're an established director who just wants to meet him.
Yeah, yeah. And so there was a appointment made, like 2 o'clock. So I go to this little office building.
You're so like me.
And I have like my poster and a tube and everything. And 2 goes and 2:30 goes and 3 goes, 3:30. And I'm getting ready to leave, and like 4 o'clock, here comes Billy Wilder, like crossing the street, and I'm like, "Excuse me, Mr. Wilder, Cameron Crowe, I'm here. CAA was supposed to call you to tell you that I had an appointment." He's like, "I got no call. I got no call from CAA. Why don't they call me for work? Why don't they call me for work? If they call me, they should call me for work." Well, okay. Who am I signing this poster? You want to sign a poster? What to sign a poster?
So, dear Cameron, get me a fucking job.
I go up to his office, and he signs the poster. And starts talking to me about Cary Grant. And I'm like, I'm sitting in fucking Billy Wilder's office and he's telling me Cary Grant stories.
Yeah.
Thinks I'm like a PA for somebody at CAA. He hasn't quite put it together.
Right.
Starts telling me a little
attention.
Shit about like they should have called me for this and that. And, you know, Schindler's List was mine at a certain point. And like, that's great. I go, Mr. Wilder, I'm making a movie and myself, and I would like you to play a part in it. I am not an actor. Hire an actor. I'm like, no, but it's great. It's like you're a sports agent's mentor. Okay. You come and find me.
How much
you
gonna pay?
I do it. I was so happy. I went to get some cigars. I brought him back some cigars. Jerry Maguire comes together. We're in the rehearsals. I haven't been able to get a hold of him. Tom Cruise is standing there, and Cruise goes, "When do we get to meet Billy Wilder?" I go, "Let me call him." So I call his office, and you know, miracle, he picks up the phone. Hello. I go, Mr. Wilder, it's Cameron Crowe. Whoa, who? I'm the guy. I'm doing this movie with Tom Cruise, and we had talked about a part, and I'm just at the rehearsals, so maybe you can come and just be a part of it, you know? I'm going to piss ice water on you right now. I'm not an actor. Hire an actor. You're bothering an old man. I'm going to say goodbye to you now. Goodbye. Click. And now, like, Tom Cruise is standing there with Bonnie Hunt. Like, when's he coming?
Yeah.
And I said,
Billy Wilder's
from
my dad.
I think he's not in a good mood today. And, you know, I'll try him. It's like raining. It's a terrible kind of moody situation. Cruise, who you know, goes, let's go to him right now. Damn. Come on. Where's your keys? Let's go. So now I'm driving through the rainy streets with Tom Cruise going, please don't let me get in an accident because it is Tom Cruise. Number one's in the car, traveling. So we get to the office. Thank goodness Billy Wilder is still there. He opens the door. He looks annoyed. Then he looks next to me and sees it's Tom Cruise and suddenly says, come in.
What took you so long?
And proceeds to flirt with Tom Cruise the whole time we're there, like just loving, lashing him with no's. Like Tom's like, we really want you to play this part. No, you must hire an actor. No.
I mean, why would I want to be in a movie with you, Tom Cruise?
Tell me why. Why would you make such a movie? What is the purpose? I'm going, oh, fuck, Billy Wilder, do not unravel the movie in rehearsal with Tom Cruise. Because Tom's like, tell him about the movie. I'm like, it's sports agent. And I kind of like tell him a story, and Wilder's listening and is not sparkling with love for this story. And Cruise is looking at him and looking at me, and I'm going, everything's going to be shit because of this. Wilder goes, how will you have sympathy for such a sports agent? How will you have sympathy? I go, well, a little kid tells him to fuck off in the beginning and his heart breaks and I think Lemon should have had more problems with him in the apartment. I think Lemon should have had a limp. So something like a limp would have helped us with the sympathy. And Cruz is looking at me and I'm going, well, I think Jerry Maguire is a very sympathetic character and I think you're going to love it. I think you're going to love it. Okay. Nice to meet you. And nice to meet you, especially you, he says to Tom.
Yeah. I'm delighted.
And delighted. And we leave. And of course, he doesn't play the part. We hire the business affairs guy at TriStar, who is so not an actor, but was fantastic. Movie comes out. First week goes by. Phone rings. It says Billy Wilder on the caller ID. So I'm shitting already. I pick up, hello, Mr. Cameron Crowe. I enjoy your picture. Who is this guy who played my part? Well, he wasn't really an actor. He was good. He was good. I liked him very much. I liked the Billy Bob Thornton movie this year a little bit more than yours, but yours is good. Yours is good. Come and visit me if you'd like to do something for your column. And I go, I don't really have a column, but I'm going to come visit you. He says, okay, same place. I'll be there tomorrow.
I got to get a o'clock. Column.
Yeah, so I went and just started interviewing him for my column, which didn't exist.
Yeah, you were an army archer.
And turned into the book, which he argued against, like, do they really care about me? Do they really want a book of me talking? Does this generation really care? And in the course of these interviews, Alec, Sam Mendes would show up and Curtis Hanson would come along on some of these things. And Jerry Moss, Herb Alpert's partner, was Billy's, music friend. And he would come along on stuff. And Billy just started to really get into the idea of this book project. And he said one night, and this was like a huge thing, we went out to dinner with his wife. And Audrey was amazing. And Audrey goes to the bathroom. So now it's just the two of us. I've been interviewing Billy Wilder for about a year and a half. And he goes, okay, is this book really going to come out? And I said, yeah, of course. And he said, because if this was all just for you, it's fine. And I realized he was basically telling me, if you wanted film school with Billy Wilder, right.
If
that's
you're fooling
cool.
me.
That's cool.
Oh,
that's
wow.
cool.
Oh.
But what I sensed was, I'd like to read it before I check out. I'd like the book to come out at a point where
when's
I live in the
out?
Same world,
because
I'm not the youngest guy in the world.
Oh.
So I threw it into overdrive. We finished the book. He loved the book, Alec. It was great. Oh, Vanity Fair asked him right before he died. Asked him what was on his bedstand, and he said, "Conversations with Wilder."
A fitting tribute to two incredible talents. In his films, Cameron Crowe has used songs from Simon and Garfunkel, Yes, Rod Stewart, Lou Reed, Peter Gabriel, Paul McCartney, and several cuts from another band we both love, The Who. For example, getting in tune in the opening scenes of Jerry Maguire, underlining Tom Cruise's intensifying emotions as he writes his mission statement. As an actor who's worked with Cameron Crowe, I can confirm he's the greatest partner you could possibly have in filmmaking. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios.